statement they want for an expanding oil-by-rail operation. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billing.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that is probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I'll put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent, but that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. And I'll really have no worries, I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery.
Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek. I'm tapped into the vibe and the rhythm of the river of the city of Portland, and you are too, because you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Seems like recently, the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good because they have the words green or renewable in them. But then when you dig into them more deeply, it turns out that not only are they a waste of precious time, but they actually are climate solutions that are worse for the climate. It's like chasing chimeras, a beast from Greek mythology, which sounds fabulous, but ends up to be a fanciful illusion.
Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a new documentary by veteran producer Barbara Bernstein, premieres on Locus Focus, Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m. Tune into Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or 91.9 FM Hood River, or anywhere in the world streaming online at kboo.fm. That's Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions on Locus Focus, Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we have the unique honor of talking with Marissa Richmond. Marissa is a professor from Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and is a filed an amicus brief recently on the case of Skirmity, which is a case that was the transgender teens trying to access gender-affirming care in a state in Tennessee where the right to gender-affirming care has been denied. So we're going to talk with Marissa about the case and about kind of what's going on with transgender folks and how we can advocate. Marissa is a decades-long activist and somebody who has made a real mark in the world as an advocate for transgender rights. Marissa, welcome to Transpositive. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you. I'm a native of Nashville, Tennessee. I moved back here when I finished graduate school. I just retired in May after 32 years. I was a professor of history and women's gender studies. So I was the last 18 years, I was at Middle Tennessee State University. Being an academic gave me the freedom to become an advocate. I had some freedom of scheduling, and then had some credibility being an educator and trying to use my voice and use my privilege to advocate for equal rights and fair treatment for trans people in employment, healthcare, housing, lately sports, so I've just been around doing a lot of that work, as you noted, for many, many years.
Great. Yeah, you helped to form. Did you start the Tennessee Transgender Political Action Committee?
Yeah, Tennessee Transgender Political Coalition. We did initially; it was a political action committee, and then we realized the PAC actually had a specific connotation because everybody kept asking us for money, and we didn't have any. You know, I said if I wanted to pay bribes, I might get a bag of Hershey. Yeah, so we you know fought. Coordinate across the state, advocating for equal rights and things like healthcare benefits. Among our biggest wins were the employment non-discrimination policies with Federal Express in Memphis and Vanderbilt University here in Nashville, and they happen to be the two biggest private employers in the state. We also had a lot of local successes with various policies, non-discrimination, and a few school anti-bullying policies. We haven't, and with the state level, the state universities adopted a number of non-discrimination policies for trans people. So, but we haven't been able to get anything through the state legislature, and it's become more and more hostile in recent years.
Question?
Yeah, I was on the Human Relations Commission. I served two terms, and I was term limited. And I was actually chair my next to last year. And so I'm one of, at that time, I was like the third trans person in the country to chair a local human rights or human relations commission. I'm now on the Metro Historical Commission. And back in September, we dedicated an historical marker to singer Jackie Shane. And it's apparently, we were told, it's only the fourth historical marker for a trans person anywhere in the entire country and the very first one in the South. So we're real proud of being able to document that. And Jackie was a native of Nashville who moved to Canada, something a lot of people are talking about these days, because she was trying to escape both transphobia and racism back in 1959 when she moved. But she moved back to Nashville and she passed away here, and her family was there, and the trans community came out in big numbers, and I spoke and a few other people spoke at the ceremony, and we were so glad to be able to honor her and recognize her for the work that she did as a musician and entertainer.
And then I also know that you've served as a delegate to the Democratic National Convention.
Right. I've been a delegate four times. The first one was 2008. Then I did it again in 2012, in 2020, and then this year in 2024. And each time we keep increasing our numbers. So we were, I think, 45 this year, the greatest number of trans delegates ever. And so we are real proud of that achievement, even though we did not have a podium speaker. And to be honest, we were kind of frustrated about that. We had Sarah McBride, who just got elected to Congress, spoke in 2016. in Danica, Rome in 2020, although that was a virtual meeting. So we said, you know, we'd like two speakers this time, and we'd like some diversity, not just white women, because the trans community is across the spectrum. And we were frustrated we didn't have any speakers at all. But we did have our largest group of transgender delegates ever this past summer in Chicago.
So the reason that we're talking today is because there was a case recently argued before the Supreme Court about 6 weeks ago, the Scrimeti case. And it is really bound to be a landmark decision on the issue of transgender rights. It's not the final decision. It's just going to help establish a precedent. I think over the long run, it's going to help establish a precedent for creating a basis for argumentation around transgender rights. But first, you know, we have to have a case. And this is this is only the second case argued before the Supreme Court that has to deal with transgender issues. And this one was specifically about transgender kids and their participation in sports. And it was filed in Tennessee, which is your home state. And you helped to file an amicus briefing on the case. And you just have a lot of information and understanding around this case and issues that affect transgender people. So let's get started. Let's go ahead and talk about the case.
Okay. Well, as I had mentioned earlier, our legislature, the Tennessee General Assembly, has become more and more hostile and has passed a number of anti-trans bills. I think we're up to 18 or something that have actually passed and signed into law. I think Tennessee has more transphobic laws than any other single state. Texas and Florida get all the attention. They're bigger states, but we've got the worst record of any state. And it's like the Tennessee Titans getting, you know, the first pick in the NFL draft. It's like we're number one, but it, not in a good way. So one of those laws bans providing gender-affirming care to trans youth. And we've seen some advances, and especially with the Vanderbilt Medical Center. They had a very nice clinic, and when it opened several years ago, it actually got a lot of very positive attention. And then Matt Walsh moved here, and he went after the Boston Children's Hospital, but couldn't get anywhere because Massachusetts has a non-discrimination law in place that was actually voted on by the voters of Massachusetts. But we have no such protection. So when he moved to Nashville, he learned about the Vanderbilt program, and he targeted that and scared all these legislators. And these national groups are passing this legislation around, and they find a very friendly audience from the people here in Tennessee. And so it passed 2 or 3 years ago. And so a lot of parents were alarmed, again, because this was designed to, you know, to stop. Well, the program was designed to help trans people and trans youth. And we had a lot of trans-friendly doctors around the Nashville area and maybe elsewhere in the state. And we're concerned about the ability of trans youth to gain access to gender-affirming care, to life-affirming care. And so families organized, and they filed a lawsuit through the American Civil Liberties Union. And Jonathan Scrimeti, by the way, is the Attorney General of Tennessee. And in Tennessee, when lawsuits are filed against their state, they're usually list either the governor or the Attorney General or sometimes the Secretary of State. And in this case, they chose the Attorney General. So that's why his name is on there. And Scrimeti is very, very transphobic. He's even pushed lawsuits to try to overturn the employment case under what's known as the Bostock ruling. Employment discrimination is actually covered for trans people under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VII bans sex discrimination, and the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that we are covered by that. And Scrimeti wants to get rid of that ruling to allow people to discriminate. So anyway, so he has a terrible record. And so, but his name is on the case. And so the ACLU officially filed the case here in Tennessee, and it worked its way through the federal courts. And I signed on through the what was then known as the Transgender Legal Defense Education Fund. They have now become advocates for trans equality. But I filed an amicus brief actually on five separate cases, and the Tennessee case is just the one that went to the Supreme Court. And as you noted, it was argued in front of the Supreme Court by Chase Strangio, an openly trans attorney who's been to Nashville and helped us lobby at the Capitol, state Capitol here. And so I guess that argument was December 4th, if I remember the exact date. And so, you know, in my case, as a trans adult, I talked about in my amicus brief why access to healthcare is critically important to many of us, and that we should not sanction any form of discrimination.
Were you present? Did you follow the arguments in person?
Follow it here at home. I did not go to D.C. because I actually had to go to D.C. the very next week. And I just, you know, there was obviously a lot of expense if I tried to stay over. So I did try to listen to it online as best I could. I thought Chase did a wonderful job. I thought it was really interesting. At one point, John Roberts says, "We're not doctors, so we should not be making this decision." And I'm like, exactly, that the state legislature, they're not doctors either. That should be left to medical professionals to work with the families and get politicians out of this. And I don't think even Chief Justice Roberts saw the irony in his own statement.
So let's go back to the court case for just a minute. So the children who were involved in this case, I mean, obviously their parents filed for them, but are they still in the school system? I mean, would they benefit in any way from this decision, or have they already, you know, graduated, matriculated out?
As far as I know, the children involved are still under 18, so they're still minors. So as far as I can tell, they would still be affected.
So let's talk about the case for a couple of minutes. I mean, I think that, am I correct? This was a case about gender-affirming care. Is that correct?
Hormone therapy, puberty blockers, you know, that's even, you know, positive therapy. You know, that's what we're talking about. And so they just want to deny any form of care. You know, obviously, they didn't say we're only recognizing conversion therapy, but the implication is that's what they want. They want to convert back and stick them back in the closet.
So the law that was passed in Tennessee that they were, that had been brought to the Supreme Court that they were challenging. So you're saying that the law that was passed banned all forms of gender-affirming care, even including counseling?
Even friendly counseling, yeah. Anything that would recommend, you know, therapy, or recommend hormone therapy, or recommend the puberty blockers, that it would potentially criminalize those medical professionals. So we're seeing some of them leaving the state. One pediatrician in Nashville moved to Alabama. they're friendly to Tennessee. That tells you a lot.
So the law as it was written, it targeted medical professionals and parents, at least I think that's my understanding of it.
For supporting their kids in this particular legislation. Okay, here it is. It was 2021 is when the law passed. 21.
Okay, thank you.
What about school administrators? Did it also target school administrators?
I'm not sure. I mean, there were bills that passed that related to schools, but school administrators, I think the school issues are separate from this particular case. If a school, for instance, was willing to recognize a person's gender change and be respectful, they were trying to ban that, but that was done separately from the healthcare ban. In Tennessee, our Constitution requires that any amendments to a bill must relate to the general topic of the bill. So if it's about healthcare, you cannot add education to that. It has to be specific to healthcare.
Oh, I see. Okay, so this was filed on behalf of these three children by the parents, and it's about gender-affirming care. Now, did this go to the Tennessee Supreme Court?
Right to federal court. So it went to federal district court, and initially we won, but then they reversed it, and so it went to we're part of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is four states, Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, and Michigan, and their headquarters is up in Cincinnati. So we went through the Sixth Circuit and then lost there. So that's when the appeal was filed to the Supreme Court.
Okay, okay. Why is this a federal case rather than a state case if it was a state law?
Well, we could, because it is a state law, we could have filed in state court, but the lawyers made the decision to go to federal court because we did have that employment ruling, and between that, my cat's like making noise over there, between the employment ruling, which rules that sex discrimination is covered by federal civil rights law, and of course the 14th Amendment. And I would even throw in the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures. And I think it's all persons should be secure in their persons. I mean, we're talking about our bodies. I think that was the reason why they chose. I wasn't involved in making the decision on whether to file federal or state, but I think that's why they chose federal, feeling that the federal constitution did offer protections as well as, again, federal legislation, including the Medicare and Medicaid Act, which have similar sex discrimination bans to the Civil Rights Act of 64 sex discrimination ban.
I see. So by filing in federal court, they felt they had a better chance because they had more protections, I suppose, than the state of Tennessee would have offered if they had filed in state court.
We used to, but there was a constitutional amendment here in 2014 that banned abortion. The assumption was that, we had bodily autonomy prior to 2014. And so that was obviously in advance of the Dobbs ruling. But the concern was that up until then, we had actually stronger protection in the state constitution. And essentially that constitutional amendment took a lot of that protection away. And so I think that was also part of the factor in making the decision to go to federal court.
So earlier in our conversation, Marissa, you mentioned you were talking about somebody who has been traveling around the country, kind of looking for states that have weaker laws or that where there's some holes that he can basically take advantage of to really target transgender teens and to, kind of manipulate the system to deny transgender people their health care. But I can't remember what his name was, but it sounds like he's somebody who is doing some really despicable stuff. Who is that?
Matt Walsh. He was a right-wing blogger. I think he's a regular on Fox News, that sort of thing. And his mission to attack transgender rights. And so when he failed in Boston, he happened to move to Nashville. He found out about the Vanderbilt program. And so he held a rally at the state capitol to target trans rights. And so he's kind of made it his mission to cause all sorts of headaches for the trans community, especially here in the state of Tennessee, since he now lives here.
Oh, thanks for the clarification. So he moved to Tennessee. Now, were his activities instrumental in the passage of this 2021 law denying transgender kids access to gender-affirming care?
Yes, because he was up at the state capitol saying, you need to address this.
So I've kind of a long-winded question, which is pretty typical of how I ask questions. But so how did it feel to be in Tennessee at the time that this case was being argued? I think it was, December 4th. And, of course, I'm also just kind of, I feel like in order for us to I can't remember if it was Justice Conan Barrett or I don't even know if I got that name right. Sorry, I don't know my Supreme Court justices as well as I should, but I do know the arguments that they made. And so one of the arguments that was being made was that we don't even have a historical record yet as an oppressed group in comparison with, say, you know, women as a class, people of color as a class, people with disabilities as a class, who have an established record as a historically marginalized people. Even though, of course, we know we've been marginalized and we've been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years, but we haven't been engaged in the legal process long enough yet to establish a legal record of discrimination, which was one of the arguments made against this case. So anyways, but how did it feel to be in Tennessee at the time that this case was being argued? That must have been really, really interesting.
Well, concern. I mean, we're realistic about the Supreme Court. It doesn't look good. And, you know, it's a very right-wing leaning court. But, you know, the feeling was we have to do this. You know, we can't just keep telling children, wait, wait, wait. You know, we've, as a community, have encouraged parents to listen to their kids, to take the time to learn and try to be supportive. And there are growing numbers of parents who are doing just that. And we recognize this as part of the backlash against our success in doing that. You know, we didn't want to have to go to court. You know, we didn't want to have to fight any of these battles at all. But we feel that it was absolutely necessary to protect those children and to, you know, who are ready now and don't want to wait, you know, 4, 6, 8 years. You know, if they're ready at the age of 14, why make them wait?
So, I mean, in Tennessee, you know, what are kids doing? I mean, kids who need gender-affirming care right now, you know, they're transgender, they know that they need appropriate medical care, and they live in Tennessee. So, I mean, what are they doing right now to get that care? How are they, I mean, what's, basically, what's happening right now in Tennessee for gender-affirming care?
It's just, well, for the children, the minors, it's just ground to a halt. You know, the doctors are afraid, and they're no longer providing care. And as I mentioned, you know, one who was leading the way here in Nashville moved to Alabama, more of a friendlier environment of all places. And so, you know, so families are starting to move. I've seen several families say, I have to protect my children. Those who either don't want to move or can't move, you know, are trying to fight back as best they can. You know, it's not easy. And when the bill was before the legislature, parents went up there, some of them in tears, saying, I'm trying to protect my children. I'm trying to save my children. And they're frustrated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just, you know, they were just simply being ignored. And some of those legislators were acting like the parents were the problem. And, you know, it's the legislators who are the problem. The parents are trying to be supportive of their kids because they love their kids and they're trying to save the lives of their kids. And that's what we were trying to make, you know, make them aware of with no success at the legislature, although we have some friends and allies, but not enough. We have a Republican supermajority here. And then, you know, of course, that was part of the key argument before the courts.
So what are kids still able to do in Tennessee to get gender-affirming care? I mean, for instance, you know, are they still able to use their pronouns in school? Are they still able to at least dress appropriately in a gender-affirming way that, you know, at least affirms their identity? How's that going?
It depends on the school. There are a handful of schools that are still supportive, But increasingly, they have gone after school policies, and of course bathrooms, even in. Yeah. So we have a school bathroom law that's in place that was also passed in 2021 as part of this kind of rush that they were pushing through, it's in a large urban area, especially Nashville. Our school system actually is pretty good, but once you get out into the more rural areas, it goes downhill fast.
Uh-huh. What about going out of state? Are trans kids able to maybe go out of state to get the services that they need and then come back into state to continue their education?
Yes, although the closest is Illinois. And so not everybody can travel. Not everybody can afford to travel. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem. But Illinois is the closest state to Tennessee, at least here in Middle Tennessee. I don't know what the difference is, but for us in this area, it's Illinois. And so there's, people being encouraged to look to go out of state. So now when the legislature comes back on January 14th, we're expecting them to try to ban even that practice.
But I mean, can they really do that, Marissa? I mean, you're a citizen of the United States, not a citizen of the state of Tennessee. I mean, how can they ban people from interstate travel to seek medical services when you're a U.S. citizen?
Right, but there are several states. Texas is, I think, considering similar legislation. And, I mean, so, they don't care about constitutional rights. They never talk about constitutional rights except the Second Amendment. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they do push such legislation, but we would have to challenge that in court again.
So, it sounds like... It sounds like they're trying to limit the right of interstate travel and also interstate commerce. I mean, well, I don't know what you would call it exactly. I mean, if I just say I'm just a regular person and I want to go to an adjacent state to get Botox, for instance, say I want some cosmetic surgery, I want to get Botox, I live in a rural part of my state and they don't offer it where I live, so I want to go to the closest big city, which is another state. I mean, they can't limit my right to travel to that state to get a medical procedure. I mean, how are they even going to enforce something like that? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree with you. But our legislature, they don't think in those terms.
Right, right. Yeah, and of course, as you mentioned, there's many others. There's kids...
So, Marissa, how many kids are we actually talking about here? I mean, when we're talking about kids who are seeking gender-affirming care, I mean, we can't really be talking about a lot of people because, I mean, we know statistically that the population of transgender kids is pretty small. I mean, it seems like the Republicans are just trying to make a mountain out of a molehill here. How many kids are we actually talking about? I don't know how many. Do you have any idea?
Any raw numbers? I mean, but we're probably only talking about, maybe a few hundred at the most. And if you want to put it in terms of schools, we're talking maybe one or two per school class. Right. And we've got, some schools here with 3,000 students. And so... you're not talking about a very large percentage of children. And my case, I didn't come out till I was an adult. I mean, I knew mm-hmm. But I didn't come out in those days. And, the numbers of trans kids coming out of the closet is still very, very small.
Now, Chase Strangio, who argued the case. He did a great job. I mean, he has a bright future. I hope that he's the next Democratic administration's nominee for the Supreme Court. I mean, he was amazing. And he did a great job arguing that, you know, this is a life-saving procedure. This, you know, having gender-affirming care prevents transgender teenagers from committing suicide. So it's a health preventative measure. And that's a great case. But just to, you know, just to argue the other side, because I did listen to all the justices' arguments, and as much as I hate to say his name, but I'm going to say it. Okay, Justice Thomas made the argument, why can't these kids, you know, there's other things that you can only do when you turn 18. I mean, this was the direction that his line of questioning was going, and he didn't say these words verbatim. But, you know, I mean, what do we tell people when they ask us this, you know, as the justices did? I mean, why can't you just wait till you're 18? I mean, when you're 18, you can drink, you can smoke, you can vote. There's all these rights that you get when you're an adult and you can make decisions for yourself. So why can't these kids, why can't they just wait till they're 18? I mean, what's the problem with that?
Why should we deny a person the right to live their life as they want to, as they feel that it's right? And what we're trying to do is to keep them alive, because there's a lot of people, even youth, who will take their own lives. And we've seen that happen. We've had suicides of trans youth here in Tennessee and elsewhere around the country because they give up. And we want to keep them alive. We don't want them to give up on themselves.
So another argument that was made by a conservative Supreme Court justice, I can't remember if it was Alito or I don't know, one of the conservative Supreme, well, they're all conservative. Well, no, that's not true. But the conservative justices, you know, one of them asked the question, I think it was about gender fluidity when he was questioning Chase Strangio. And he talked about how, like, you know, a teenager might say one day that they're gender fluid, the next day they might say that they're transgender, the next day they might say they're non-binary. I mean, the implication was basically that gender fluidity was an important consideration in these arguments about whether or not kids should get gender-affirming care. And so I guess what I'm just kind of wondering about is how do we address that issue when we're making this argument to people? I mean, this was a question that came up before the Supreme Court. It's a legitimate question. I mean, of course, it shouldn't limit access to gender-affirming care for kids who are transgender. But I mean, how do we explain a complicated issue like gender fluidity to the public?
Well, a lot of people who are gender fluid generally don't take hormone blockers. I'm not aware of people doing that. You know, if people, you know, transition or detransition, it's usually not because they made a mistake, but a lot of times it's in response to hostility from society, and they just realize they couldn't handle that hostility. And so the problem is society, not the individual. At least that's my argument.
So now then, what do we tell people about, you know, things like puberty blockers and, you know, cross-sex hormones? I mean, when is the appropriate age, you know, for kids to start taking these things? And, you know, how do we have this conversation with the public? Because that seems to be really at the core of this issue. So, you know, when's the appropriate age? How do we have this conversation?
Well, first off, I point out that when someone does take hormones, it is with parental permission. It's the right wing is acting like parents are out of this, and or they're manipulating the kids, and neither one of those is true. They're supporting the kids. And the parents usually take some time to do research and to try to understand what their kids are going through. because most parents, you know, it's not something they study in high school biology classes. And so, you know, the parents are simply trying to understand their kids and come to a feeling that they need to support their kids because they want their kids to thrive and survive. And also we point out that hormones are reversible. You know, some people are thinking that this is like drastic surgeries we're talking about. And we're just talking about hormones and puberty blockers. And all of that's reversible. And if you go on blockers and then come off of them, the puberty will start. It may start later in life, but it will happen. And people seem, I was actually in a conversation with a restaurant owner. And when I pointed that out, she goes, "Oh, really? I didn't know that." You know, and that's the thing. I mean, we haven't done a very good job of getting that part of it out to the public.
So what have people been saying to you, Marissa, since the case was argued? It's been about a month now. You know, obviously the Supreme Court probably isn't going to issue a decision on a case like this until the end of the term. So we probably won't hear about it until June. But, you know, obviously this was a really big case. It's going to have a big impact on establishing precedent for our rights. You know, what have you heard? What have people been saying to you about the case? What have you been hearing?
Well, I think most people understand the makeup of the court. It's not good. We're not... we're very concerned about what they will rule. Shannon Minter, who is an attorney with the National Center for Lesbian Rights, says, you know, we may win this. We might still win this. But most people I know are kind of pessimistic given the state of the court. One thing we're pointing out is that for a number of years, marriage equality was a losing issue for the gay and lesbian community. And then there was a sort of a shift that took place. And we're going to get there. You mentioned that, you know, at the very beginning of the program, and we're going to get there, but we may not be there yet. And that's what does concern a lot of people, that a lot of people could get hurt, and we may lose some people before attitudes change. But we've been making progress. You know, the election of Sarah McBride is probably the most visible example of that. And so we are making significant progress around the country, and several states are passing non-discrimination laws. California, I think it was, they just said you cannot ban books. You know, just I feel unimaginable. We're in the 21st century and we're talking about, you know, people banning books. And in Tennessee, one of the school districts just banned the book Wicked. It's only the number one book. And they're banning Wicked. You know, I mean, that's the extremism that we're dealing with here. And so, you know, we're getting close, and that's why the right wing is freaking out. And that's why this backlash is so intense. But we're getting closer. We're getting closer. And we know that. So, but people will get hurt until we get
to. So I guess one of my last questions and one of my main concerns is just, you know, was it worth it to file this case? I mean, knowing the composition of the court, knowing that it's more likely than not to fail, and you know, basically considerations about how is this going to impact our rights as citizens? I mean, of course, you should always file a case. I mean, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that. You should always file a case, and you should advocate for your rights. But still, given the composition of the court at this time, you know, what was the ACLU? What was their reasoning behind filing this case, considering it was more likely than not to probably lose, given the current composition of the court?
Well, I wasn't part of those discussions with the ACLU, but I assume so, yes. I have seen some online discussions from cisgender people saying, you know, this is going to set back the movement. But, you know, I counter, that, you know, we're trying to save the lives of these children here in Tennessee. And that's why it's important that this case move forward. You know, we are concerned about if, you know, the long-term impact of this, if we lose, but we're concerned about the impact if we didn't even fight. You know, we have to fight. I've felt and green to be part of this, that this was the right thing for us to do on behalf of these children.
So the other question that I had been meaning to ask you was basically about, I don't know how to put this. It's one of the concerns I have about the Scrimeti case, I'm just going to be really blunt here, is that I'm really concerned about how this could affect other rights. I mean, other aspects of law as it applies to transgender people. I mean, could this be, is this just an outright ban on healthcare for trans-affirming kids? So, for instance, like Idaho has a similar ban. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of the state of Tennessee in this case and Scrimeti, then I guess, you know, that means that Idaho doesn't need to also go to the Supreme Court to try to enact a similar ban. So, but is it just limited to this area of law, or could it be applied to other aspects of law? I mean, that's really my concern. That was always my concern with Scrimeti, was just that this has the potential to establish precedent. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't understand anything about the law, but I'm just concerned about if this could, if they rule against us, and I understand there's a chance they might rule in favor of us, but if they rule against us, could this establish a precedent for going after other aspects of law that, you know, are not enumerated in this case?
Well, we're particularly concerned about adult healthcare bans. You know, if they are susceptible to ban it for youth, then they can ban it for adults. And so that's what we're really alarmed about. You know, so yeah, I mean, there is a dangerous precedent, and we're willing to acknowledge that. But again,
I mean, they could do that anyway. So, right.
Yeah, but that would give them, and by the way, I'm on that Idaho case along with Arkansas, Florida, and Oklahoma. So I mentioned mm-hmm. several other states in Idaho, Poe versus Labrador, and that's in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so, but these other cases are all at the appellate court level, and obviously they're all waiting for the Supreme Court ruling. And you know, so but we understand the potential implications at a broader scale. Especially in the area of healthcare. If they can ban it for children, they can ban it for adults. And there's already a state senator here in Tennessee who's talking about bringing such legislation, although they may wait until the second session, which would be next year, to try to move forward on that, although they could go ahead and file the bill this year and then just hold off until after the Supreme Court rules.
So I know that Tennessee's always been a conservative state. I mean, I knew you when I lived in Tennessee, and you know, I've lived in Tennessee. I know what it's like to be there. But you know, I always thought of Tennessee as kind of a blue and a red state. I mean, it used to have Al Gore, and you know, it had a mix. So what happened to Tennessee? You know, what's going on in the South right now?
It flipped in 2008, the night that Barack Obama got elected. And
racism.
Yeah, and we are a Southern state. We were a slave state. We were part of the Confederacy. We were a Jim Crow state. And we still have a legacy of all of that that's still there. And you know, the right wing demonized Barack Obama. And what's happened is that extremist element on the far right, they're the ones winning the races. They're winning the Republican primaries. They're winning the general elections. And they're saying, we're going to protect Tennessee values as if we're not part of the United States. And like I said, they ignore the Constitution. And when I testified a few years ago when the bathroom bill was first introduced, and I pointed out the way the bill was written, that it would violate, if you know, because it actually included higher education at that time, and my office happened to be right across the hall from the bathroom. So I said I would be the bathroom police, not exactly what they were looking for. And I said, so if I enforce this, or no matter what I do, I'm either violating the Fourth Amendment or the 14th Amendment. And you could see them shaking and getting all red in the face, angry that I was quoting the Constitution. And they didn't want to hear about the Constitution and people's constitutional rights. They were absolutely furious with me for bringing that up.
So, Marissa, you're an advocate for our rights as a community. I mean, you've been out there for a long time in the trenches doing the hard work. You know, you're a retiring professor, and you've been out here doing this work for a long time. So, Marissa, what is the way forward for our community? Like, based on your experience as an advocate, your decades long experience, and all of the work that you've done, you know, for the community, what are you seeing as the way forward for the specifically for the transgender community? What do we need to do now?
Well, one thing is visibility. We need to, you know, people who can come out of the closet need to do so. I know not everybody's in a safe space, especially in the rural parts of the state. But even if they're not out of the closet, they need to think about how they vote, and voting for pro-equality candidates and holding people accountable. You don't have to say, I'm trans, but not supporting candidates who are transphobic and holding their feet to the fire, and you know, continuing to push our so-called friends and allies. We need you to stand up for us. We need you to fight for us, because we can't do it all alone. We're too small a population. We can't do this. You know, when you look back at, you know, the women's rights movement got the 19th Amendment by getting men to support them and helping men understand why women had to vote. The civil rights movement succeeded in getting things like the Civil Rights Act of 64 and voting rights in 65 by getting whites to understand why this was important. So we have to build political alliances. And so when you talked about political connections, that's part of my mission. And, you know, some people, you know, prefer to go at it in a different way, but that's part of my goal, is to help educate people with political power, and to help move them forward in support of equal rights.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Marissa, if people would like to get involved in supporting this kind of process, where are some places you would suggest they go to either educate themselves or to say, hey, I want to help out?
Well, there's all these national legal groups. I've mentioned several of them: the American Civil Liberties Union, Lambda Legal, Advocates for Trans Equality, you can start with those groups. I'm wearing a T-shirt here for the Tennessee Equality Project, and TEP lobbies at the state capitol. And so, we're not on camera for the show, so they can't read it. But every state has a state advocacy group. Some actually have trans-specific advocacy groups. And so get involved. I saw a statement, you know, people always want to start new groups. Well, start by looking to see what's out there and ask the right questions and ask people who you do know are politically active. Is there a group I can get involved with? I'm interested in doing this. And so, ask those questions and don't make assumptions. Just because you don't know about something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We need people to step up, and especially, again, our cisgender allies, our family members. You know, if you're a person of faith, the people you go to church or synagogue or mosque with, if you are, you know, your coworkers, help them understand. I was just in a store recently, and I had my overcoat, and I had a trans pin on, and the clerk said, "I love your pin." You know, so I mean, just little things like that, you know, are the way we help educate people and start those conversations.
Great, thank you. And Marissa, if people would like to get in touch with you, if you feel like sharing any sort of way that people can contact you, I'd love it if you could share that.
The easiest way is on Facebook. I'm not on Instagram or LinkedIn, but I am on Facebook. I'm very active on Facebook. Marissa Richmond, M-A-R-I-S-A with one S, and then Richmond, just like the city. And, you know, send me a friend request. And I, you know, not everything I post is political, but a lot of stuff has been political. I admit, since the election, it's been kind of, I've been trying to find other topics to discuss because it's been kind of depressing. And in fact, I think right now, the day we're taping this, Congress is in the process of certifying the electoral vote. And I'm not sitting in front of my TV, and I don't plan to. I just can't bear to watch it, but I will get back to talking politics on my Facebook page and sharing information about things that are happening and what people can do about it.
All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, Marissa. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today on Transpositive.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your co-workers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing forward discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Thank you.
walking lightly. What's up around me seems to always be. Every night and day, I hang my head and weep, yes, and weep. I love my baby, I want it for myself. If he don't be mine, he won't have nobody else. He has left me, I'll do the best I can. I must do like Keith, get a friend any place I land. Now I got the don't have blues, can't be satisfied.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive Jurors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.